Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Today's first day of the rest of your life, Josh.
It feels like it. I mean, for sure.
Josh and I just finished recording on the big teaching project we've made reference to here and again,
you know,
over the last few months. And, you know, we're not, you know, the class is ongoing, but a lot of the big, you know, behind the scenes work of recording material we finished yesterday.
So. Yeah, you know, it's an accomplishment. And part of it is like, I'm embarrassed to tell people about it generally because it doesn't seem
like— It's just work.
It's just work. And, and generally you shouldn't talk to, like, except for your spouse, you really shouldn't talk to people about your work ideally. But every once in a while you're like, yeah, how many students? Like, yeah, like over 1,000. Like, what?
Yeah.
And it's like, how much content have you guys— It's like, you know—
A lot.
A lot, you know, in the, you know, would it be, you know, more or less than 30 hours? It's definitely more,
yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's a nice, it is the first day of the rest of our lives.
There you go.
I'm feeling it. The birds are chirping.
Well, it's funny.
The breeze.
Yeah, like I said, I went to see Jeff Tweedy last night, and there was a moment of sitting there in the Paramount watching the show, which I enjoyed fine, but also just the general sense of having a little mental space to be able to enjoy something was kind of nice.
Yeah.
Without back processing
federalism, you know, interest group formation or whatever.
Yeah. And how to talk about it without getting fired. So, which, you know, it's kind of a burden, but not a bad one, as you say.
It was
I've said all summer, like, look, spending a lot of time on this. I'm not out mining coal or digging trenches in the hot sun. You know?
No, and I said to you this morning, I mean, one of the things, at least for me, and we'll move on from this in a second, is going back and going over all this core, you know, fundamental stuff about government, you know, looking at the Constitution, thinking about the development of, you know, institutions and rights and all these different kinds of things, you know, honestly, in some ways, kind of invigorating now that it's done.
Yeah.
You know, at least for me, I can
say
that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I, you know, revisited thinking about things I hadn't thought about in a while.
Yeah, it's
always good.
Good for everybody.
Good for everybody, unless you're out there listening going, okay, get on with it. So we had to skip last week due to other commitments. So we still have some, you know, pent up thoughts on the most recent UT Texas Politics Project poll, some of which we'll talk about today, but who knows, you may be back next week mining that yet again.
Yeah. We want to give people something to listen to while they travel with their family for Thanksgiving.
There you go. You know,
some road trip music.
Give thanks for public opinion. You know, a lot of things going on in the news. Seems silly, not that we have to get into it, but not mention, you know, big national news story, shutdown's over. And I think a couple weeks ago, we did some public opinion, looked at some of the public opinion on the shutdown and talked about that in a, you know, sort of parallel intro level newscast we've been doing for the course this week.
Yeah.
Shutdown's over, you know, politics kind of swirling around that. Bumped off the headlines yesterday by the initial released strategically by Democrats initially, and then a strategic counter response by congressional Republicans of more documents, emails related to the Epstein situation, case, you know, history, the history of Epstein and that. You know, I don't know if there's anything you want to say about either of those. I mean,
You know, on the former, I'll just say, you know, because we didn't really talk about it too much in here, you know, the quick takeaway from the polling on the government shutdown was just to say that, you know, everybody was kind of getting dinged. I mean, and part of that is because, you know, people from the other party would, you know, disapprove of the job that, you know, the other party's doing. Independents disapproved of everybody. People who aren't super partisan disapproved of everybody. But then the problem was, and we saw this in the polling, was that, you know, but for the most part, like, Republicans were mostly approving of the Republicans, you know, on this. Democrats were mostly approving of the Democrats. And so, I mean, I think, you know, to the extent the shutdown went on longer, you know, than maybe than other shutdowns have and all that, that was part of the reinforcing factor. And if you want to get like highfalutin about, you know, this is polarization. These are all these things, yeah, you know, that we talk about all the time. And that's kind of why it was harder in some ways to get out of.
Yeah,
this
I think the highfalutin part of that, I think, was important. I kind of emphasized that in talking to folks about the in the initial wave of after the poll release, yeah, that, you know, for the umpteen time, you could see, you know, the negative partisan identification at work in the responses to the shutdown. As you say, you know, Democrats were largely supportive of their mm-hmm. partisans, Republicans largely supportive of their partisans and how they were handling the shutdown. But the disapproval of the other side was higher than the approval of your own team. And that, I think that did help extend it. And what we know about what we're hearing about the narrative, mm-hmm. you know, to some extent, I think supports that view. I mean, the fact that, you know, the moderates in the Senate on the Democratic side who wound up voting to end the shutdown and were crucial to that happening, you know, had decided a couple weeks ago, I think, that those talks were underway. And at least the reporting is that the Democratic leadership, Chuck Schumer, wanted them to hang on a little longer, at least until they saw what happened with the elections.
Yeah.
You know, that Democrats did well in.
And that makes sense.
And that was, you know, kind of inconsistent with that explanation.
Politics.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And that was the other piece to the
poll. And politics in a highly partisan environment.
And the other piece to that is just to say that, you know, the poll also found that, you know, yeah, people are concerned about the cost of healthcare. So that was the Democrats' argument. That was there. We saw that on the uptick with, you know, obviously a lot of attention to the increase in prices on the ACA marketplace, especially here in Texas. We've talked about that. But we also saw, you know, just a general widespread perception, including among Republicans, that the shutdown was bad for the state of Texas. Like, yeah. I mean, so it wasn't as though anybody was out there saying, well, good. I mean, now let me rephrase. There are some people out there who are saying that, but there are very few people, I think, who are out there saying this is just going to be a great because now we're going to see we don't need the government or whatever. Their views were pretty, you know, I think reasonable
And it was, you know, the way it unfolded in the last couple of weeks after we came out of the field was fairly I hate saying predictable because always always sounds like, oh, I knew it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, but in the sense that the longer it went on as people, and we had kind of flagged this in the podcast a few weeks ago when it started, as the effects of the shutdown began to multiply, both the primary effects and the secondary effects, it was going to be harder for everybody to hold the line.
There are no real winners in shutdowns for those. They're just who loses the least. And then on the Epstein stuff, that's one of those, I got to wait and see. I mean, you know, of all the things that are floating around out there, this is the one that sort of, you know, and again, from even a public opinion standpoint, it surprises me the salience that this seems to have, especially in certain quarters of the electorate, in ways that just, you know, I think defy a little bit of, you know, I don't know, reasonable expectations. You know, there's so much that's always going on. And right now, more than anything, and I think it's funny, you know, you mentioned it. Yes, it's like Democrats release an email or two, Republicans are, well, here's 22,000 pages, which really does reflect, I think, in a lot of ways, you know, what kind of a lot of part of the, really from the top down idea of flooding the zone.
Yeah.
Approach to this is, but it's also like, I'm curious to see what the tail on this looks like, how long this stays in the news, you know, because it has defied some expectations, at least for me.
Well, and there's a lot of other stuff that's in there that is going to give people other things to talk about and whether that, you know, extends the tail or like what that looks like.
Whether that works as intended.
Well,
or,
I mean, you know, you know, not to ignore, I mean, the obvious headline of, you know, Donald Trump being mentioned and these ways that are not as clear as probably anybody would like.
Right.
You know, on either side.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just very Rorschach-y kind of thing going on here probably. Mm-hmm. But kind of the secondary stuff that's coming out of that, I think, is, you know, I mean, who knew, you know, Epstein had like a correspondence relationship with Larry Summers, right? I mean, not that I'm shocked by that, but it's any, you know, and even more so I was, you know, with a, you know, longtime member of the press last night, and we were talking about the Michael Wolff part, and I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
Yeah, you know, the author Michael Wolff has written these books about, you know who he is. And yeah, for our readers, you know, he's written some books about Trump. Longtime journalist. He's done, but has always been kind of a controversial guy in terms of, you know, his use of confidential sources. It's, you know, but even more than that, his relationship, I think, with some of the sources. And, you know, there's some really eyebrow-raising stuff in there. If you haven't seen it, go see the emails where, you know, Michael Wolff is giving Epstein advice about how his communication strategy vis-a-vis Trump in a way that is, you know, pretty shocking if you accept, you know, some of the basic old school conventions of journalism. So for those of you who haven't seen it, I, you know, those
also
emails
for your
are,
long Thanksgiving trips.
Yeah, all over the place. But that's, you know, I mean, if you haven't seen that, Josh, I mean, it's, I, you know, I almost noticed that more than I, you know, the Trump stuff was kind of the Trump stuff.
Well, and that was the one thing for him is, I mean, and his allies, it's easy enough for them to say, well, we know about this. But I mean,
right.
I think, you know, I'm curious to see whether that extinguishes it at this point or not. Because it does seem to not be going.
I think they're going to have a little trouble extinguishing it. But there is already, you know, the kind of morning newsletters and looking at, you know, kind of what's out there in the blogosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting to see how it all, you know, how this sorts out. But there is a lot of, there's a little bit of reversion to the norm on this in terms of, you know, the line. Yeah, there's really, see, told you, there's really nothing here. Yeah, well, you knew, they knew each other, blah, blah, blah. Anyway,
you,
I don't want to get too
far
into
Or you knew that and everything
that.
Else you're seeing is what we've been telling you anyway, or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, I'm expecting this to play out a lot, like so many other things with this administration, with Trump, and with in particular with this Epstein thing, is that at some level, people are going to revert, you know, to some fairly predictable positions and but you know, been wrong before.
Yeah, we'll see.
So at any rate, also a couple of good, you know, Texas current event hooks that we kind of want to focus on today, I think, that we can use as the points of entry for some of the data from the poll, some of which we talked about, some of which we haven't. You know, and again, this is not earth-shattering news and not, and there's nothing surprising here per se, but things to notice, and that is Governor Greg Abbott formally kicked off his reelection campaign this past weekend, I think on Sunday in Houston. You know, there was a lot in that speech, and I wanted to excerpt the speech for the podcast, but it was a very windy night in Houston, and a lot of the audio that I thought was best, to be kind to our listeners,
I'm gonna subject you to
nobody
that.
Needs to hear a bunch of wind blowing in a microphone and when we can kind of give you the gist. And when we post this on the website, we'll all link the video to the post at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. You know, just to frame it a little bit, it was an interesting mix of speaking to the moment in that pretty early on in the speech, the governor used a lot of affordability, cost of living framing.
Mm-hmm.
To talk about, you know, what was important, what the camp, they had done, and tying some of the things to that. In my view, a lot of the achievements he was tying to that, the linkage was a little tenuous, but nonetheless, it did lay the, you know, clear the way for talking about a huge expense for Texans, as to paraphrase the governor, and that would be this kind of centerpiece that's gotten a lot of media attention and that the Abbott campaign has promoted on property tax reduction.
Right.
And we've talked a lot about property tax reduction in here.
Oh,
and there's a good, you know, I mean, I do not take this as a policy analysis, but there's a, the Abbott campaign circulated, you know, a one-pager on this on social media and to the press, you know, that talks a lot about what they're talking about doing. And, you know, we were talking about it before, and you think about property taxes a lot. Everybody does, which is kind of or a lot of people do, which is kind of the point here. But, you know, I was wondering what you made of this.
Well, you know, I think it reflects the challenge that, you know, Abbott is honestly facing both in the moment and just in both in the moment, as you said, you know, of the moment, right, in terms of what people are concerned about, you know, but also sort of the moment and sort of the longer term trajectory of the state and just sort of ultimately, you know, what is and is not possible, right? Yeah. And I mean, and I think, you know, one of the things is, you know, the focus on affordability, not surprising, right? I mean, and part of that is we see it all over the polling. We talked about it. I mean,
they're doing any polling at all with any, you know, general mood testing. They're
going to see the economy in there. They're going to see cost of living.
It's like everyone else.
Yeah, they're going to see cost of living, and there's a real concern. Housing's a real concern. And we've talked about this before, but, you know, the legislature, or really, I mean, honestly, Texas in and of itself doesn't have a ton of levers at its disposal to really dramatically, you know, address these sort of things head on, but the best, I mean, I don't say the best, but the most obvious, maybe, if not the best way they can attack this problem is through, you know, taxes, fees, the costs of living that they control loosely, and they don't really directly control it. But But it sort of walks up into the sort of tricky thing, which is, you know, again, we've been cutting property taxes like consistently for the last decade, like, and aggressively with increases in the homestead exemption. You know, on the flip side, the legislature has, we just had, a tax rate election here in Austin that failed Prop Q. The legislature.
On the same day, we had a constitutional amendment election that passed.
Another huge increase in the homestead exemption.
And a couple of carve-outs.
A bunch of carve-outs. I mean, well, actually, to be clear, I think 2/3 of the 17 proposals on the constitutional amendment election had to do with taxes or a reduction in taxes or a prohibition on taxes of some sort. And so this really becomes the vehicle. But the challenge is that on the other piece of this, which is also part of this pronged approach, is to keep the localities from increasing taxes too quickly.
Right.
Well, again, this went from an 8.5% rollback election trigger to a 3.5%. And then there was discussion, obviously, at the end of the session to say, well, what if we did 1%? And we talked about this in here, that just the practicality of that is non-existent, just to put a wrap a bow around it really quickly in terms of the fact the elections would probably cost more than the savings in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And most localities would be having elections to approve every single budget. And in some ways, that's kind of where it went off the rails. Now, this is where I think campaigning and actual legislating diverge pretty dramatically, right? And you look at sort of, what Abbott is proposing, broadly. And again, this is just campaigning. We're adults here. You can say whatever you want. And ultimately, he's not in the legislative branch. But ultimately, what he wants to do is he wants to tighten those spending limits on localities. And right now, it's sort of, sort of do something kind of like the state does with its budget and sort of have some sort of an additional lever to control it based on inflation or population, right? So that's one possibility. But the other side is, if there's going to be if there's going to be a tax rate election, majority is not enough for that. We need 2/3.
And we've heard this.
Floated
in the legislature.
Before. Right. And then the other one was, essentially give Texans or give local voters the ability to initiate a rollback election, basically in this case, but it only requires 15% of voters to do that. And I think, what do I think? I think this is a reasonable, way to approach the issue from a political standpoint.
Right, because certainly our polling has shown that on one hand, you've got all these actions that they've been taking, and partisans appreciate it.
Yeah.
But it hasn't changed a lot of people's baseline attitudes about property taxes being too high.
Yeah.
And their expectations that they're going to have to pay more in the future.
Yeah, well, and I think there's just
pretty consistent results, right?
Well, and there's just sort of I hate to, be bitchy about it, but there's just such a basic math aspect of this is when they sort of say like, okay, we're increasing the homestead exemption from $100,000 to $140,000. What do you say? Huge increase, right? 40% increase. That's a humongous increase. And so what's that going to save the average? They put all these calculations. Well, save the average homeowner about $450 or somewhere in that range, whatever, $400 or $500. And then you say, okay, cool. Divide that by 12. Right.
Yeah.
And then you're talking about, the way that most homeowners see it, which means they don't really see it because, we talk about everything that we've been constantly being reminded of over the course of the last year. But like, well, how much more do eggs cost? How much more, is electricity costing? Right. Because the electricity rates are going up in all these places, because of data. I mean, in a lot of these places, because of data centers, other things, increased demand. How much more does everything cost? And it eats up this savings almost immediately.
Right.
And that becomes the challenge here is that you're sort of forced to say, we're addressing your problem. No, really, we are. Don't you know? No, we're not actually asking. Because when we ask, people are kind of like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, and there's the other kind of macro level aspect of this, which is, the two things that stick out to me about this are one, and you've done a good job of posing why this is happening to some degree, which is...
Stylized it, that. But.
Well, I mean, the idea that, if you're going to do this.
Yeah.
And you're going to try to reduce property taxes and hold all other revenue generating sources equal, you've got to put the pressure on local governments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Full stop, right?
Right.
And that has implications not just that are fiscal, but also in terms of local governance, decision making, local autonomy, all of these things that have been brewing now for, 10, 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of came to a head session before last with the so-called Death Star bill.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, another big step on that, but in that direction, and just looking at the language of the campaign, looking at their campaign one-pager, you just kind of say the state of Texas does not levy any property tax.
Right.
Period. Local governments control your property taxes and can raise them. But there are limited options for taxpayers to lower their own tax bills. So, the focus on local government and local governance is a very interesting kind of macro level development here, you know?
And yet familiar, right?
By this point, it's not a surprising step,
but
other than the specifics that you were talking about and, you know, frankly, the impracticality of a lot of it.
Well, it's interesting to me because, I mean, again, it's not, and it's just to lay it out quickly, it's not surprising to see this turn towards local governments because ultimately there is no Democratic figurehead to run against. There's no Democratic president. The Democrats aren't controlling the Congress. There's no clear statewide leader of the Democratic Party to point to and say, this, you know, let's go after this guy. And truthfully, you know, paying attention to Gavin Newsom is a sideshow and, you know, useful when useful, right?
Right.
And so ultimately you're left with the cities. But I guess I wonder, and I mean, I'll pose this back to you. I mean, I wonder just thinking this far out, you know, if this becomes sort of part and parcel of this approach is like, how does a campaign potentially, and I mean, I'm looking at this, I'm not thinking this is crazy, just knowing what I know about the environment, largely or at least primarily centered around sort of, you know, chastising the cities of Texas.
Right.
How far does that take people? I mean, in terms of addressing the problems that we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think this kind of goes back to the overall composition of the speech the other
day.
And this is why I really wanted to quote some stuff. So they had to, you know, just buy some wind protectors, guys.
Yeah.
You know, the speech was an interesting amalgamation, you know, as these rollout speeches are, you know, not, there's nothing that different about this. It's also the same with a victory speech, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll hear a different, we'll see. There was a definite mixture of, I mean, the tax section of the speech is actually not that long.
Yeah.
Right? It's not really, to my mind, the centerpiece rhetorically of the speech. You know, there were lots of, you know, the greatest hits.
Yeah.
You know, immigration enforcement.
Right.
You know, a lot about, you know, economic growth in the state and, you know, a lot of, you know, very classic Abbott touch points. So I think in that sense, I mean, you know, it's funny. We were talking about media and strategy in another context earlier today offline. But this is another kind of manifestation of this, you know, there's always a little something for different factions in a political speech like this. That's not new.
Yeah.
But I mean, the extent to which
even before TikTok.
There was definitely, you know, a lot of other parts of this speech that will be bolted onto this and that were still good applause lines.
Yeah.
You know, with the crowd.
Right.
So, you know, it's easy to focus on this. And I think, you know, for us, it's a little bit,
But it's interesting. You know, but I mean, I do think it's important.
It's easy to drill down into the policy stuff and to look at the bigger trajectory stuff. And there's a certain amount of business as usual going on here.
But I think it's important to focus on this because ultimately, you know, this is a two-step process. And right now, you know, Abbott needs to win the primary, which he is almost certain to do.
Yeah.
And he's done a remarkable job of clearing the field of any potential, you know, serious challengers to that.
$80+ million plus the potential to raise still more will do that for you.
That'll help. But also he's taken on, you know, some niche issues that, you know, if festering can lead to just annoyances, you know, in terms of the primary. And so I think, you know, it's not surprising to have, you know, him hitting these things. I mean, obviously he wants to max out vote totals. He wants to be the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, all those things. But I mean, I think what's notable is knowing what we know about where the electorate is right now in the economy and, you know, not expecting, and there's, you know, I'd say there's mixed currents out there for sure, but not expecting a wholesale, you know, turnaround in terms of people's perceptions within the next year. I think this is an important piece to focus on because I think, you know, we went into the last legislative session, we said to people, hey, what is the thing they should be focused on? People were focused on cost of living if they weren't focused on immigration and the border, just to say.
Right.
And in general, the concern about costs has not gone away, and it's a bipartisan concern. I mean, that's something else that's really important here. This isn't just Democrats wringing their hands because Trump's in the White House.
Yes.
We see it among Republicans, too. They're concerned about the cost of housing. They're concerned about the cost of living. It's there. Maybe a little less intense, but it's
and it's a trope in the press right in, you know, the national media right now that while Trump's advisors want him to talk more about affordability, they want him to be available more domestically and to hit those notes.
Yeah, it's a little challenging.
But it's challenging, you know, and it's challenging for him in particular, I think, because he doesn't, you know, that's really not his mode. to talk about. I mean, you know, the reflex has been to go and say, yeah, we, you know, this is more, I think, Bessent or the Treasury Secretary rather than, mm-hmm. but kind of going back and saying, well, you know, look, we inherited this mess, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera,
I saw
et cetera.
That.
Which,
well,
again.
But I mean, what I think about, I mean, where I can't help but, and again, we're just speculating
know,
off into the future, but I mean, it's a podcast, is what this is. I mean, one of the things I can't help but thinking about is O'Rourke's run against Abbott. And, you know, in that election, again, not a good year for Democrats,
yeah.
you know, what have you. But, you know, we generally, at that point in time, we still saw immigration and border security as a top issue here,
yeah.
top issue among Republicans, big issue for independents. And because of the border crossings, it was an increasingly an issue among a lot of Democrats. And, you know, one of the criticisms that I levied in this podcast against O'Rourke is that, you know, his position on immigration was kind of unknown. And it was
yeah.
kind of really the sort of thing that he just avoided. And I think, you know, you can't run in a campaign in a statewide election, look at what the main issues the voters tell you about and just sort of seed the field in this big issue.
Yeah.
And I think if you flip these around a little and you say, okay, well, if the 2026 elections are largely people focused on the economy, you know, Abbott can't very well not talk about, you know, people's economic conditions, cost of living, this kind
yeah.
of stuff. And I think, you know, what we've seen, we saw it in the legislative session in terms of the way what they were willing to do and what they couldn't do. And what we're seeing now is that this is the vehicle by which, you know, Republican statewide leadership has chosen to address
right.
the cost and affordability problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I haven't really thought of, I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit. I think we had Darren on the pod a couple weeks ago, but as you're saying that, it's also like, you know, I mean, I think I said at the time that you could also vector this concern with property taxes and the dissatisfaction to the you know,
yeah.
it's aggravated by the broader economic
well,
concerns. It's almost like you could add property taxes to the list of things that people are price sensitive about.
Well, yeah, right? you know, and I yeah. mean, like, I don't want to make this.
There's a different way of putting it.
Well, I don't want to make this too hyper local, but I mean, if you've been in Austin and you know about the Prop Q vote and how that went down, I mean, there were a lot. You know, people say, "Oh, well, even Austinites getting sick of their property." You know, whatever.
Yeah.
There's the various, you know, sort of stone throwing that's going on. But if you kind of talk to people around town, I mean, there's just a lot of people who you would know who, as generally pretty progressive or liberal people who are just like, oh, geez, I don't know. Another
yeah.
one? You know, like, can we just, like, you know, and because,
right.
and that's because the economic pressures were, for most people, kind of overwhelming whatever other sense
yeah.
they had about these things in a way that's very reasonable.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, the question becomes, you know, again, outside of all the other factors is, you know, how effective of a vehicle is this to address people's concerns? And is cloaking
yeah.
it in this notion of, well, it's the cities that are doing this to you. It's not the Republican statewide
yeah.
leadership of the last 20 years. I think, look, there's a case to be made. We're increasing the homestead exemption. We've been doing all these things to try to, like, make your cost of living more manageable. But I guess what I wonder is, you know, does this as a vehicle, is this effective? When
yeah.
you say, you know, we talk about issue ownership, where whoever the Democrat comes in, they say, well, geez, you know, whatever they're going to say, Texas doesn't spend anything on people, blah, 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 low social safety net, you know,
yeah.
they want to, you know, blah, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I just wonder which is going to be the more effective, how effective that's going to be, you know?
Yeah, well.
I mean, given that we know that these constant property tax reductions haven't led to, like, people saying, boy, this is so much better.
Well, and I think they are trying to anticipate a little bit of the campaign in here. And
yeah.
I, you know, if you're going to anticipate. And one of the proposals that's not on the sheet in the notes, because there's another page to this that isn't here, but one of the things I really notice is that one of the proposals is to, you know, is the promise to try to de-link property taxes and school funding, which, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually a real approach to potentially.
Right. But it's also a real approach that would require a pretty big bucket of money from the legislature.
Well, yeah, I mean, given that, I mean,
right.
not to go back into the course mode, but given that the state is constitutionally required
yes.
to establish and set up that system, if they take
and
that—
And to balance the budget.
Yeah, and to balance the budget, that's going to be, that's a big lift.
Right, and that it's not been, you know, there's already a big predicate among Republican primary voters and Republican legislators say, no, we support the public schools, but the problem is, like, they're spending, you know, they're wasting money in superintendents and administrators and DEI and,
right.
you know, whatever. You know, there's not, you know, there is not a critical mass
yeah.
for reallocating another big chunk of recurring money to the schools, period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But it's an interesting rhetorical trap, I think, if you are running against a Democratic candidate who wants to ding you on public education,
mm-hmm.
because then you can say, look, we are trying, you know, we're going to fix this. And the problem is we're going to, you know, we're going to fix two problems at once
right.
with property taxes and education. And then that so are you telling me you're not for cutting property taxes
and increasing public education?
Right.
Funding.
Oh, so that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
Yeah. Right.
Right. And I, you know, there's an answer to that.
Yeah.
If you're
a
deft campaign candidate.
You raise the real issue though, which is, and I'm just going to say, as absurd as the notion under the current revenue generating structure that we have in the state of eliminating the property tax, which some people, including the governor, have floated as a perfectly reasonable policy idea. The problem is on the Democratic side, you're in the position of saying, oh, so you don't want to get rid of the property tax?
Right.
And it's like, well, what, so you want to keep it? You want to raise it? Like, what
do you? Well, and look, as a friend of mine who's pointing out recently, you know, I mean, very clearly, you would think the Democrats would be able to say, "Look, you can say whatever you want, but this is you. You have been in charge.
Right.
You are running for a fourth term.
Yeah. Why haven't you done it already?
Well, I mean, why are we still talking about this if you're so sure this is the solution?
Right.
What have you been doing?
Yeah.
But you know, will they do that? And, you know, do you have somebody that's capable of really delivering that message and sticking to it and, you know, in a powerful way? And I, you know, we'll see. So,
yeah, we'll see.
But let's look, you know, the other thing that's linked to this. So,
you
know, Governor Abbott gives a speech, declares, you know, puts his hat formally in the ring. 2 days later, endorsed by Donald Trump.
Boop, boop. There you go.
You know, pretty helpful in a Republican, you know, it doesn't really matter, but helpful in a Republican primary.
I mean,
Governor Abbott is not a state legislator looking to fight off a challenger or something. But it does, you know, point to Trump's position in Texas vis-a-vis the statewide sphere.
Yeah. I mean, look, there was no doubt that he was going to endorse him. I think, you know, in some ways, getting it over with quickly in some ways is almost like, I don't want to say it's like it. To me, it almost shows less value in it. And somebody's like, you're not saving it for a special moment when you need it.
Because
part of that's because he just doesn't need it. But obviously, if he didn't get it, it would be weird and all that kind of stuff.
It can be in all the, you know, appropriately targeted ads from day one.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, you know, that is what it is. But it's an interesting moment in the arc of like where we are in time, looking at the public opinion data, both for Abbott and for Trump, really, right? So, I mean, you know, we can make a lot of points of comparison, but I mean, it's been interesting to watch over the course of the year, sort of when we started really looking at these ratings and, you know, maybe December or February, depending on what ratings we're looking at, and then sort of through to October and seeing in some ways, and I'm going to phrase it this way and you can kind of, you push back or, you know, you adjust. But I mean, it seems to me that as we've watched, you know, Abbott really get closer to Trump, or whether Trump has pulled him in or whatever metaphor or analogy you want to use, it doesn't really seem like it's benefited Abbott in the public very well. And as we've seen Trump's numbers trend downward in the overall electorate, we've also watched Abbott's numbers trend downward as well. And it's hard not to look at those things together. And part of it is just the nature of the underlying data, right?
Right.
So, I mean, let me just kind of like lay out some of this.
You jump
in whenever, you know. But if we look at where Greg Abbott was, you know, a real high watermark was at the end of last year in December. 55% of Texans approved of the job he was doing, 34% disapproved. Maybe they were fat and happy on, you know, Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever. February, he was still at 48-37. So very healthy job approval number. If we jump ahead to October right now, he's at 39 approved, 50 disapproved, which is the worst rating of his entire governorship, which is an interesting, I mean, it's just interesting to bring out. As he announces for re-election, this is actually at his worst rating. In December, among Republicans, he was at 83% approval. In February, he was at 82% approval. Today, he's at 76%. So
still strong.
Still strong. Now, for Democrats, in December, he was at 61% disapproval. In February, he was at 75%. Now, this is notable. I just want to point out historically, what we've tended to see is that, you know, when Abbott is, I think, at his, I think, his strongest and most adept, he has a certain matter-of-fact authority about himself and the things that he's taking on in a way that, you know, generally appeals to at least a small minority of Democrats as well as other people. And he usually would get some level of approval, which is why the disapproval was
kind of high single digits, and at the highest points, kind of low doubles.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, years ago, you know, many years ago, it could get up almost into the 15 to 20 point range.
That was during the initial COVID thing.
And even before that.
Yeah.
But since then, we don't see that as much. But again, in February, 75% disapproval. In October among Democrats, same as August, 89% disapproval. Right. So we look at that. We look at independents. You know, he was at 23.39 in February. Today, he's at 24.58.
Yeah.
Not great. Now,
58 is a troubling number, I think. Well, that's, I mean, it's not fatal or whatever, but it's, you know.
Well, you know, what it is that
not helpful.
The same questions people are asking us about Donald Trump, I think, point us to questions about Greg Abbott. And it's not about, you know, like, oh, is Greg Abbott in trouble? We're not fools. We're not going to sit here and say Greg Abbott's in trouble. You shouldn't listen. If you're listening to a podcast and someone's like, well, Greg Abbott's in trouble, I would say, you know, listen to our podcast instead, probably. But I think, you know, there are warning signs of a challenging environment. And some of this is the stuff we've been talking about, you know, the economic stuff, but some of it is really has to do with the types of groups in the electorate that we think of that are key to how competitive an election is or not. And we think about independents, we think about Hispanics, and we think about suburban voters largely is like a good barometer of kind of what the mood looks like.
And on the other side, how mobilized are Democrats? But we'll get to
Right.
Yeah.
But if we look at where, you know, the movement among Greg Abbott, among these groups, you know, in February, you know, he was 23 approve, 39 disapprove among independents. Today, it's 24-58. In February, among Hispanics, he was at a pretty respectable 40-42. 40 approve, 42 disapprove. Today, it's 29-58. And that 29 approve is a low for him. In the suburbs, back in December, that's just the number I pulled, he was at 49 approve, 40 disapprove. Today, in the suburbs, it's 36-54. If we think about the really fast-growing, competitive counties in the state, like that's what we're talking about. And we don't have to go into all these numbers. I'll just say this kind of tracks what's happened with Donald Trump. If we just focus on those groups, if we say, you know, look in the suburbs, he was at 51-41 in February entering the presidency. Today, he's at 39-54. And among Hispanics, he was 44-46 in February. Now he's 32-59. So these are sort of the groups that, you know, we would say this is what's going to make the environment more or less competitive. And then I think for us, you know, what I'm looking at, the thing, okay, so what is the messaging that Abbott's putting out there look like, given that, you know, here's the parts of the electorate that he needs to probably a little bit of help mobilizing and sort of bringing back.
And look, the property tax thing speaks to that.
And the property tax thing speaks to that. The suburbs, for sure.
Yeah.
And when you talk about Hispanics, I mean, really what you're, I mean, just to say it out loud, like this is the plurality group in Texas. So what are you talking about? You're talking about a lot of people who live in the suburbs. You're talking about a lot of people who live in the cities. You're talking about a lot of Texans. And so it is right down the middle in terms of when you think about persuadable groups and what they care about. And again, we've been talking about this a lot, but the lack of just sort of durable partisan attachment among Hispanics. This is a persuadable group here right now. And this is a group you are fighting over. And I think the real thing I noticed when looking through the polling data, some of the change is that, you know, and we talked about this years ago, but it's sort of, I was noticing it again. What's changed for Republicans isn't so much that, you know, I wouldn't say that their ceiling is so high because who knows what the ceiling is, but the floor has gotten higher. You know, in terms of when we say, like, what share of Hispanics are approving of the job, you know, Greg Abbott's doing, Donald Trump's doing, Republicans. And Donald Trump, I think, is probably largely to credit for a lot of that, along with Republican efforts to mobilize these voters more generally. But the floor is lower. I mean, it's just like, you know, Democrats, there's not like an unlimited number of Hispanic voters that Democrats can just keep going and keep targeting, right? But nonetheless, Democrats need this to even be competitive. That's the other way to flip this, is to say, is Greg Abbott in trouble? No. The other side is, can Democrats have an environment that's, you know, gives them a chance to be competitive? And you look at this and you say, yeah, possibly. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I guess, you
however, there's some challenges still.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, you know, what I shouldn't even say wrestle with. I mean, the uncertainty that I have, like, in mind, front and center, is you look at these numbers and you also look at, you know, the things we've talked about, and we talked about these on the podcast with Darren a couple weeks ago without being too repetitive. But, you know, I mean, the overall theme of the last couple of polls has been people are not in a great state of mind about how things are going.
Right.
And so we can, you know, we can trace all those declines in approval levels and favorability ratings. But when you look at that also in the context of the track numbers, the economy numbers, I don't really want to, you know, I'm reluctant to, you know, and I was had some people ask me this recently, say, yeah, you know, the leadership's numbers are down, they're vulnerable. Now, that could be true as a function of the overall environment, but it also makes me reluctant to say, you know, as you caveated, you know, this candidate is in trouble.
Yeah.
This incumbent is in trouble because, look, if it, you know, in some senses, they're just all in not the greatest space right now. And, you know, look, we've been through enough of these cycles. As they get into campaign mode and start sending out public messaging and making public contact with their base, you know, as they start running a campaign without
spending that $80 million.
Yeah. Right. And you have a lot of money to do that. You know, we know, and we know what the partisan environment is, that there will be very likely some reversion to a more of a mean pattern here, which will probably boost the in-party ratings.
Yeah.
And I think that that gives me, you know, I mean, it makes this, you know, the thing that we've talked about endlessly in here, and we will talk about endlessly again until November.
Right.
You know, what is, you know, what is the reliability of the traditional midterm pattern for the art party, blah, yeah, blah, blah, all of that, which everybody knows what I'm talking about. So, you know, and we look at, and the big question is the Democratic numbers, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
and the state of the Democratic Party, which, yeah, this shutdown thing, again, could help in the medium term, but in the short run is re-raising all these questions about, you know, WTF is going on in the Democratic Party and what are they going to do?
Yeah, and I think, and that comes up in the numbers, right? So, you know, when we ask about favorability numbers towards the party,
yeah,
you know, first of all, it's not surprising. I think we mentioned this already. It's not surprising to have a majority of voters disapproving of both parties or having an unfavorable view of both parties, which say that's all the opposing party and some significant share of independents, right? So they, right, should be underwater.
Because the independents kind of hate everybody.
They hate everybody. That's why they're independents. But, you know, the Republicans are in a better position than the Democrats in Texas right now. 38% have a favorable view of the Republicans, 51% an unfavorable view. Among the Democrats, 31-54. So it's a little bit worse for the Democrats. But this is the notable thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
80% of Republicans have a favorable view of their own party. Only 69% of Democrats say that they have a favorable view of the Democratic Party right now. 18%, which I'd say it's almost 1 in 5 Democrats, have an unfavorable view of their own party.
Because, like, the kind of default mean of, you know, looking at the, you know, for both parties, you know, you should be at least in the high 70s or the low 80s.
Yeah.
And
the Democrats have historically, at least in Texas, looking back over the trend, have been a little bit lower than Republicans.
Right,
but the Democrats.
That makes sense, though. Yeah. You know, when your team's losing all the time.
Yeah. But they should be at 3/4, let's just say. I mean, it doesn't, yeah, have to, we're not even talking about intensity here. They should have at least 3 out of 4 Democrats would say, yeah, that party that I'm
part of. Yeah, we like those. I like my guys, fine.
Now, I mean, the leaderlessness of the Democratic Party is obviously, you know, making this a challenge right now because, yeah, what it is and, you know, which Democratic Party do you support?
Well, and, you know, again, to read,
you know.
Yeah, that there's that problem. And just at the Texas level, and Democrats are having that problem nationally.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's worse in Texas because, you know, as I'm broken record on this, you know, the weakness of the Democratic Party in the state has become a structural feature of Texas politics.
But what's really interesting to me, just to, like, you know, I think bring this, it might even wrap this up, we'll see,
yeah,
is that, you know, the one thing that's been really notable in the polling to me, you know, one of the big shifts or one of the big changes that we've noticed is, you know, with Donald Trump ascending to the presidency, one of the things that's really fallen off of the public's agenda in Texas, and it's crazy to say this, is like immigration and the border. Republicans are significantly less concerned about this issue than they were. Republican statewide leaders are obviously talking about,
right,
it a lot less because they can't criticize the federal response. And whereas we used to see, you know, 60% of Republicans saying, oh, immigration border is the most important issue facing the state, now they're kind of splitting out across. They're focused, right, more on the economy.
Although it's still high.
It's still high. It's still a top issue. The economy is creeped back up.
But I think it's in the high 30s or around 40 now.
But
right?
The more important, maybe, yeah, thing for this is just to say that is focusing on these Democrats is that for Democrats, usually it takes a million issues, whatever, it's all these things. But now, you know, 40% or more are saying political corruption, leadership. And that's whether we say most important problem facing the country, most important problem, yeah, facing the state. And just to say, like, I mean, we don't need a bunch of, you know, complicated measures. They're focused on Donald Trump. Donald Trump, you know, I would say, you know, coalesces Democratic attitudes pretty clearly. If you watch the candidates right now who are trying to mobilize Democratic voters, they're talking about Donald Trump. They're talking about political leadership because they know that's what Democratic voters are talking about. And to the extent that Greg Abbott has, again, pulled closer to Donald Trump's orbit, that may be all that's required to coalesce the Democrats,
right,
back together, who are, you know, a little bit less happy about what's going on.
Right.
And I think that's also sort of the challenge here in sort of saying, you know, Greg Abbott goes, hey, I'm running for re-election. There's Greg, you know, there's Donald Trump. All right, get him out of here. Because honestly, he doesn't really help him that much.
Well,
beyond.
And again, you know, to this question of how do we tease out responses to particular leaders from the general,
mm-hmm,
thing, you know, and what that looks like in June, let alone September of next year.
Yeah, right.
I'm throwing up my hands.
No,
fair. You know.
We've seen enough to know, you know, let's see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, the combination of the unpredictability and, you know, the kind of, you know, the uniqueness of the current economic moment.
Yeah.
With the idiosyncratic nature of Trump's leadership and Trump's presence,
yeah,
in politics. You know, I mean, I was talking to somebody last night, IQ and I were talking about this recently. I mean, there's a certain fool me once, fool me twice thing here where, you know, you could look right now and see, like, there are issues right now in the Trump, there are tensions in the Trump coalition.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, in the party. Mm-hmm. How does he manage that? How much does that continue to manifest, you know, when it comes to election time, when you start getting people really focused on campaign messaging?
Well, and the challenge here is, as we always raise, is the issue of negative partisanship, too, which is to say that, you know, absent, you know, a particular Democrat who's leading, obviously, on the one hand, Democrats have to sort of deal with every, you know, every sort of era that comes their way. You know, at the same time, as much as sort of Trump's approach to governing has created a lot of opportunities for policy entrepreneurs to try things within the executive branch, the lack of leadership on the Democratic side also means that there's a lot of opportunity within this chaos for Democratic entrepreneurs to emerge to try to sort of take the mantle of leader. And to your point, there is no handicapping how that is going to go over the, you know, the next 6, 8, 10 months, right? Like, and that's the sort of, you know, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many things that, you know, I mean, it's so, you know, I mean, it's just so tempting to bet on the historical pattern here.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I'm still, you know, I'll be honest.
You still seem like you're leaning that way to
me.
Well,
you know.
I could be wrong. But.
No, I am. And I'll tell you.
I mean,
you,
I'm not wedding you to that. But.
No. I am. And a part of it is, and it goes back to just, and it honestly goes back to the polling data, and it goes back to looking at the polling data for just so many years. Like, Trump is a wild card in the way that he, you know, influences sort of these things that we think we know about politics, right?
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. That's fine. I just also think that the economy is one of those things that's just, we talk about all the time. It's just something that, you know, and we're here, we're big old nerds, right? We're following every little piece of this. And you all are big old nerds too. You're with us, okay? But, you know, most people are just not that engaged with this stuff, and their engagement has to do with their feeling of how things are going.
Yeah.
We already know that governing is hard. We already know that Trump has not chosen to govern in a bipartisan, bring along everybody kind of way. He's done it in a very, very partisan way that in some places really excites people, in some places really terrifies people, but also, you know, is a wash for a lot of people who are still just going to say, man, you know, I had to move, you know, rent got more expensive or whatever. Right. And so I just sort of, when people say, you know, hey, like, oh, all those negative and economic polling numbers, that stuff, that's not real. More often than not, in my experience, it's real.
Yeah.
And I think the sort of motivated arguments that people come up with to tell you why it's not real, or the fact that, you know, Trump's holding the coalition or Democratic disarray or whatever. And it's like, yeah. But like, most people are just like, yeah, the economy's not good, so who do you vote out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cliche.
Or I'm less motivated because I just don't think that you're going well, or, you know.
It's a cliche in the coverage right now, but it is, you know, I mean, it was kind of a trope in the last week or so, the kind of Trump making the mistake that Biden made.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, in terms of telling people, no, really, it's fine.
Yeah.
You're just, you know. You may not be feeling it, but actually look at the numbers or look at X or look at Y.
It's just you just didn't understand.
Yeah, right. And that's, you know, it's a loser.
It's a loser. Yeah, no. Any political argument that begins, well, don't you think if people just understood, I just say stop.
Yeah, right.
That's a world that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You got to deal with the world as it exists. And the world that exists, you know, for what, you know, take it or leave it. I think if you listen to this podcast, you probably would take it. You know, it's in the polling numbers and it's very clear. And so knowing the historical trends, I'm reluctant to say that I wouldn't expect to see that. And I also would say, and we've made this point elsewhere, maybe here, but, you know, I think Republicans see it too. Republican elites see it. That's why they're redistricting.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't think that, you know, this was a real problem, if it really was okay, they wouldn't be going through all these efforts to try to change the map, because if they left the map as it is, they know what the outcome would be and it would follow the historical patterns.
And again,
most
likely, you know, just yesterday or maybe this, you know, whenever it will, I think it might've been even this morning, but, you know, when the president signed the CR,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was talking about affordability.
Yep.
And then didn't take any questions from the press.
Yeah.
You know, which is interestingly enough, you know, kind of conventional for a very unconventional guy, which tells me, you know, to your point about Republican elites and the people mm-hmm. around him. I mean, there are people that are reading it through this frame and see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is... it's all still very unresolved.
And how the elites resolve this is going to be tricky, because, you know, as an elected official, you have to, I mean, you're selling anything. You got to speak to people's, where people are. And to the extent that, you know, and we've talked about this sort of in the context of the legislative, the budget and all these other things, but to the extent that, you know, there's no room for any Republican running for office to acknowledge any sort of difficulties other than those created by the previous administration or created by undocumented immigration, which is clearly much more under control now.
Right.
It just sort of means that you just sort of have to avoid this issue. And I just think that that, you know, puts you at an additional strategic disadvantage that's already on top of the historical trends.
I mean, there's something that, you know, is just occurring to me, and this is half-baked that I may retract this in the next podcast. But all things being equal, it does seem to me like it's one thing to seek to reframe people's, in some ways, inchoate cultural identity issues in the way that Trump did during his rise.
Okay.
It's another thing to tell people, no, let's think differently about the fact that you have less disposable income.
Right.
Or that you're living check to check and you're coming up short.
Right.
It's just, you know.
Or that your healthcare expenses are about to go up by 1,000%.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about that is, and that's part of the Democratic issue in this, you know, we need to close out. Yeah. Maybe we'll come back to this. But that's also part of this calculus about who won and who lost from the shutdown. And are the Democrats losing in the short term? And maybe they'll come back and this will rebound to their benefit in the long term. Is that hasn't quite happened yet.
Yeah.
Or at least the big predicted, you know, because of the subsidies and all this.
Right.
You know, there is something about that material part that, you know, it's hard to say, no, that's rain on your back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's nice warm rain.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just think we haven't come to the crisis point for that yet. But if that is what it's going to be about, then the Democrats, you know, should be getting ready to fight that fight. But there's a lot of agency involved in that. So with that, thanks for making it today. Thanks for the ride to work today. Thanks to our excellent production staff here, as always, in the Liberal Arts Development Studio here at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to you for listening. You can find the data we talked about and more, of course, as always, at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. Have a good rest of the week. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.